The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Okay, so we're picking up today with, I want to start with the Enlightenment, and hopefully we'll get into Reform. We'll see how we go. This particular period of history is very, very important for us because we are really in more or less the same period of time, ideologically speaking. Obviously, there's a lot of changes, what's gone on in the world since the year 1700 and after, but the basic ideology of the Enlightenment is the ideology that permeates the Western world. So if you understand what's going on, the ideology of the time, and also the Jewish people's relationship to that ideology, gives us a lot of very important insights into what we have to deal with today. This is particularly relevant material. The Enlightenment, generally, the period of time we're talking about is 1650. The Renaissance actually goes all the way into the early 17th century, the late Renaissance. We're talking about 1650 till 1850 thereabouts, a 200-year period, which we're going to call the Enlightenment. And it is characterized by several things that are very different that we haven't seen earlier. I would say the two big words that I use to describe the Enlightenment are rationalism and nationalism. And there's a lot of other things we could say, but more than anything else, we see the emergence of very strong nation states and the idea of national identity. Europe has moved from the Dark Ages of looking at sort of like as this giant thing called Christendom, or like the Western, the Latin Church, the areas controlled by the Catholic Church with less powerful monarchies, to now the idea of religion is of secondary importance. And clearly my national identity, that I'm English, that I'm French, whatever, becomes much more important. Now, granted, some of the nations of Europe are not going to become nations until very late, and even after the period of Enlightenment, such as Italy and Germany, do not emerge as nation states until late 19th century. The other idea that is very, very significant is the idea of rationalism. We talked about the Renaissance brings the idea of man back into the picture, the Middle Ages being very God-focused. So now we have an idea of man being brought into the picture, human beings being the center of all things, and it gets to the culmination of this period of time of the Enlightenment when the human mind, rational thought, what I can observe, empirical science becomes king. This is an age of tremendous focus on the individual. Out of this is going to come a lot of very positive things. We're going to have the rise of liberal democracy is going to take place at this time, very important. The scientific revolution, great leaps forward in science, industrialization of Europe. You also have the emergence of some very strong, you know, nation states such as France and especially England at this period of time, the British Empire. So it's a very, very different period of time, and God is definitely taking a back seat, which doesn't mean during the Enlightenment that all these people are going to become secular, but the introduction of secular culture, the idea of a world without religion or God in the West, is going to take root at this period of time and have big implications for Europe and definitely for the Jewish people. Yeah?
First of all, could you define nation state? And second, do you define secular as necessarily a world without God? Or
I define secular, nation, first of all, nation state, I would say, is a country with a strong central government and a monarch, let's say, as we know today. Not a weak king, let's say, or no king with a lot of noblemen running around and maybe the church overseeing what's going on in the country. But a country the way we know it today, with laws and defined borders and law throughout the land, which is something you don't see in a lot of places in medieval Europe.
Okay, so nation states have survived, and today that's what we have today.
What we have today is exactly what's emerged. We don't today. Nationalism is now in the late 20th century is micronationalism is the big thing. You know, everyone who has like a little local dialect has to make their own country, like you see in Yugoslavia or whatever. That's a new variation on the theme. But just to show you, if you look at some of the big personalities of this period of time, you appreciate a guy like Louis XIV is clearly an example of, you know, when he's. In the 17th century, king of France, you know, the sun king, the guy used to walk around saying, l'état c'est moi, you know, I am the state. Our Frenchman isn't here today. He's missing all my French. That's the kind of enlightened monarch. Doesn't mean that they're enlightened. More enlightened despot is actually a better word to describe many of these people, like a Louis XIV, who is definitely an ego, you know, as big as Versailles, which is what he built, which he bankrupted France to build. If you've ever been to Versailles, it's an incredible. You want to see what, you know, this is the guy, the sun king. This is the epitome of a strong monarch who basically makes his personal, you know, residence, which becomes the center of French court life after it's built, is the entire national building project of the whole country. In a bit of Versailles, it's an incredible place. You have to see. You want to get a sense of the power of these monarchs. But in terms, you definitely have people like that. But more importantly, intellectually, you have some very, very important people who have a huge impact on the world. John Locke, for instance, who I think he's 1632 to, I think he dies very early 18th century. Very influential political thinker, especially if you look at the history of American political thought at the time of the Revolution. He's number one. He and the Bible, I always say, are the two biggest guys, the two biggest people to shape a political thought in America before the Revolution. A person like Sir Isaac Newton, mid-17th century to also the very early 18th century. In my opinion, the greatest scientific mind in modern human history. Okay, a person who, incredible in terms of he's the one, physics is largely based on him, the principles of physics are his discovery, calculus is his invention, a tremendous, tremendous thinker. And by the way, a man who's deeply religious. Isaac Newton was obsessed with codes in the Torah and everything like that. He was a very unusual example of, in many ways, an ideal, a Gentile ideal at least, of a person who has the Greek idea of empirical observation of the world, which the Greeks excelled in, with the Jewish concept of everything emanating from God. And when you get a guy like that who's able to think both ways, you get an incredibly creative scientific mind. So he's a great example, Isaac Newton, one of my favorite characters in history. But basically, the power of religion in general takes a back seat. Okay, strong nation states, nationalism, rationalism. And it's going to have a huge impact, obviously, on Europe. The major event of the Enlightenment, I would say the watershed event of this period of time, is going to be the French Revolution in 1789, which we're going to look at in just a couple of minutes. But in terms of how it's going to affect the Jews, there's a few obvious points that come out of the Enlightenment. First of all, the less religious the Gentiles become, generally the better it's going to be for the Jew. Not totally secular atheistic like communism, but less frum goyim, as we say, are better for Jews, because when they get too religious, then they start trying to kill us for various reasons. So that's number one. But the other thing is, out of the Enlightenment and the idea of the value and the importance of the individual is obviously going to come a tremendously increased respect for human life and civil rights. No question. No question. One of the good sides of the Enlightenment. It seems that it took a long time, but the non-Jewish world, Rabbi Bullman, I remember he said this from Migdal Emek, he said it beautifully. He calls it like the great schizophrenia. He says, for 2,000 years, from Abraham until Christianity, the Gentile world could not understand any idea of man to man or man to God. God was incomprehensible. Then along comes Christianity, okay, in the West, and they finally hop the idea of God, okay? But, you know, as I mentioned, sort of, the Catholic Church was not a great social welfare institution, completely lacking in any conception of man to man. Okay, so they got the idea of God, and then 2,000 years later, right around the period of modern history, the last couple hundred years, when humanism comes in and rationalism and all that, they finally get the idea of man to man, social responsibility, human rights, values. But then what happens? They lose God, which is exactly what happened. The West lost God. And they can't, Roy Bowman, he says, beautiful idea. They can't, the world has not been able to synthesize a system that combines a close personal, a relationship with God and the system that comes from God with a relationship to man. And that's what the Jew has to do. And now he's seen, this is a beautiful idea. Now what we have to do is, now that the Gentile world finally understands the idea of man to man and man to God, we have to show them how to combine it. That's what Jewish society is all about, which is why halacha permeates all aspects of your awareness. That's a very nice idea. But anyway, the implications for the Jews, obviously, if the West is going to become, I would say, more genteel Gentiles, people who are more concerned with values and civil rights and respect for life, it's obviously going to be good for the Jew, because you have to start looking at the Jew as a human being. And believe me, through much of the history of Europe, Jews were not looked at as, either they were not human, they were animals or the devil, or they were lower life form. Okay, which is something that Hitler, unfortunately, is going to resurrect later. But we see already in the 19th century, and even earlier on, even in the 18th century, excuse me, you see in Prussia and places, Germany has not emerged as a state yet, but we'll see in Austro-Hungarian Empire that there's definitely a loosening up in the attitude towards the Jews. Whereas Jews were denied civil rights, edicts of toleration are starting to be issued, granting the Jews not citizenship, but more civil rights. You're no longer like a worm we can crush at our will, because that's not in the spirit of the times that we're now living in. Okay, so we see an improvement in Gentile treatment of Jew. Once we get to the French Revolution in 1789, which is, again, a very important event in the Enlightenment, because the king, Louis XVI, is executed with Marie Antoinette, right, the guillotine. That revolution, by the way, shakes the foundations of all of Europe, because this is very dangerous. We have, it's not the first time a monarch has been executed. We know that in the middle of the 17th century, Charles I was executed during the Puritan Revolution. But this was like a mob. This was sort of like the people rising up. It wasn't, this was like a real proletarian revolution. And the European monarchs are very threatened by this. This is a bad precedent. If Louis XVI loses his head, I could be next, you know? So Europe invades France. France is fighting a defensive war. And France also degenerates into a reign of terror, which is really brutal. The guillotine, you know, executing people, and they themselves end up being executed. You have it really, it degenerates into like, it's really a forerunner of what's going to be in communist revolution in the much, much later in history, over 100 years later. But of just a really a vicious dictatorship of the people, not really of the people, of an elite that is killing any political opponents. Napoleon Bonaparte, who's a Corsican lieutenant, rises to power. He's born in 1769, and he dies in exile in I keep getting it. Is it Elba or Saint? I think it's in Elba, the island of Elba, in 1821, because he was exiled to Saint Helena, and then he comes back. I think he dies in Elba, or it's the opposite. I'm not sure. But Napoleon, who's a Corsican lieutenant, during all the chaos that's going on in Paris, seizes the opportunity to basically take over. It's like a military coup, more or less. He becomes in charge of France, and by 1804, he is crowned Emperor of France, and his emperorship is going to last for 10 years. And he, and the reason why I'm saying this is it's extremely significant for the history of Europe and the history of the Jewish people in Europe. He embarks on a period of conquest of 10 years, a little break in the middle to go into exile and to come back again and fight the Battle of Waterloo, and then to lose that and to go into exile again and die in exile. But he embarks on a period of conquest which is almost unprecedented in terms of its rapidity of conquest. He's up there amongst one of the great military geniuses. He takes France on the offensive against all the monarchies of Europe, against the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and against the Italians and the Russians, and you name it, he beats all of them, more or less. Not totally undefeated. His winning streak is not unbroken, but more or less. Tremendous military genius. And as he expands, he brings with him the ideas of the Enlightenment. The ideas of the Enlightenment really, more than any other place were in France. Remember the motto of the French Revolution? Liberté, égalité, fraternité, right? Liberty, equality, brotherhood. Of course, they were executing people at the same time as they were screaming this, but okay, you know, ideology is always easy. Exactly. You got to break a few eggs to make a good omelet, right? So ideology is always easy to espouse and hard to follow, as we've seen all the great utopian visions of the last couple hundred years have usually degenerated into mass murder or anarchy, but that's a side point. But Napoleon, when he marches through Europe, he liberates almost all the Jewish communities from their ghettos. Okay, now already the atmosphere of freeing the Jews is in the air, but Napoleon really pushes it forward. Now, when he is defeated, and he goes to Russia, by the way, he loses his whole army, more to the Russian winter than anything else. He comes back, he goes into exile, he comes back for 100 days, fights the Battle of Waterloo, loses it, and then goes into exile where he dies. But what he puts in motion has a huge ripple effect in the history of Europe and the whole history of the world. Even though some of the Jews have returned to their ghettos as Napoleon retreats and these different monarchies and people come back into power, basically by the end of the 19th century, the notion of keeping Jews as non-citizens is no longer tenable in an environment, a more liberal environment in Europe. So Jews are granted citizenship. Okay, in every country in Europe, the last, besides Spain, which of course has the worst track record for the Jews in Europe, which does not grant Jews citizenship until 1918 and didn't rescind the expulsion order until a decade ago, the last Western European country is Switzerland, I believe, in 1874. So by the last couple of decades of the 19th century, Jews everywhere in Europe, after literally, we're talking like almost 1,000 years of being economically marginalized, physically marginalized, locked out of any trades, right, professions, are now allowed back into European society. And that, the impact of that is going to be tremendous in Jewish history. And Napoleon has a very interesting attitude towards the Jews. I personally have this theory that he wanted to be recognized as like the Messiah or something. He definitely had a big, for a little guy, he had a huge ego. I mean, he had to compensate for it by, it was very interesting at the battle of, I think when he was besieging, he comes to Israel before he's emperor. He besieges Akko. And someone takes a shot at him, which goes through his hat. And he said, once again, my hat saved my life. Something like that, you know. He was a little, if he'd been a little bit taller, it would have hit him in the forehead. A little bit shorter, so the guy missed, you know. So, but anyway, Napoleon does something. His policy was to bring the Jews fully into European society and to bring them in forcibly if necessary by ridding them of all those things that set them apart. One of his interesting ideas was that all third of Jewish marriages should be intermarriages. That way the Jews... I mean, I don't know what his intention was, but it was certainly that the Jew, as long as he lives differently and acts differently and has a different historical mission, a different vision, will not be accepted into European society. So what does he do? In 1806, Napoleon convenes an assembly of Jewish notables. Okay, he wants to start like a dialogue with the Jewish community. Like he gets back then, like the head of the UJA, whatever. These are, by the way, almost all rabbis, Orthodox rabbis. There's nothing really else in the world at the time. A year later in Paris, he gets together the assembly of Jewish, the Great Sanhedrin, where he convenes 71 religious leaders, exactly modeled on, you can see pictures of it, you know, modeled on the Sanhedrin of biblical times. And why did he convene these rabbis? Because he wanted to basically sound out the Jewish community. He was basically making overtures to the Jews, and he wanted to see what the Jewish reaction would be. I have my platform of bringing Jews into European society. What's your reaction? And this, in my opinion, is I think all politicians should study the documents. I'm going to read you some of them, but I can show you. Anyone wants to see them, I have the books that have all the questions and answers by Napoleon's emissaries to the assembly, to the Sanhedrin, and their responses. Why do I say all politicians should study them? Because, you know, politics is the art of opening your mouth and saying nothing. You know, so you want to see what these rabbis, the way they answered the questions, because they were stuck between a rock and a hard place. On one hand, they definitely wanted the Gentiles of Europe to ease up on the Jews. On the other hand, they could not possibly acquiesce to some of Napoleon's ridiculous ideas. They would mean the destruction of Judaism. So I want to read you a little bit of... This is Count Molay, Napoleon's instructions to the Assembly of Jewish Notables, July 29th, 1806. This is Paul Mendes Flohr and Yehuda Reinhardt's book, The Jew in the Modern World, which is, again, the best book of primary source material you can ever buy on modern Jewish history, meaning documents relating to it. Here's slightly edited by me. Here's some of the questions. The wish of His Majesty is that you should be Frenchmen. It remains with you to accept the proffered title. You will hear the questions submitted to you. Your duty is to answer the whole truth on every one of them. What's his name over here from France? I wish he was here. I'd have him read them. It sounds great in a French accent, you know. Is divorce allowed by Jews? Is divorce allowed by the Jewish religion? Is divorce valid when not pronounced by courts of justice and by virtue of laws in contradiction with French code? Meaning, does Jewish law supersede Jewish law supersede French civil law? Can a Jewess marry a Christian or a Jew a Christian woman? In the eyes of a Jew, are Frenchmen considered as brethren or as strangers? Do the Jews born in France and treated by the law of French citizens consider France as their country? By the way, this is one thing that's for sure. Dine de Malchusa Kedine. This is a very Jewish idea. Jews treated equally as citizens, respect the law of the land as their own, and not to do so as a chiyuv chil Hashem. That's the one question that they could answer straightforward. Okay, provided it's not contradictory to Jewish law. Okay. Now, it's obviously this is... listen to some of these questions. I mean, can you marry Gentile? You know, can you... So here's the Assembly of Jewish Notables answers to Napoleon, August 1806. So a few short weeks later, they give their answers. Listen to this. This is brilliant. I love these guys. The only marriages expressly forbidden by the law are those with the seven Canaanite nations, with Ammon and Moab and with Egyptians. The prohibition in general applies only to nations in idolatry. The Talmud declares formally that modern nations are not to be considered as such, since they worship like us the God of heaven and earth. And accordingly, there have been at several periods intermarriages between Jews and Christians in France, Spain, and Germany. But we cannot deny the opinion of the rabbis is against these marriages. The rabbis acknowledge, however, that a Jew who marries a Christian woman does not cease on that account to be considered as a Jew by his brethren. You know, it's like, yes, no, maybe, yeah, but, you know, so they say nothing. Obviously, Napoleon was satisfied, you know, they got away with it. You don't see any French persecutions of Jews because they didn't like the answers. Now, of course, this does not mean that Jews are going to be emancipated and everything is honky-dory. Yes, it does mean that during the 19th century, you have the Jews are let out of the ghettos and run into all kinds of areas and are remarkably successful. We're talking about all that Jewish drive. It was pent up for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. No Jewish doctors, no Jewish lawyers, no politicians, no nothing. And boy, do they run to do it. And Jews rise to the top like you wouldn't believe, like they have this jet-powered engine like the space shuttle on their backs. But that doesn't mean that Gentile society is going to accept the Jew. It does mean that in Western Europe, in the 19th century, you find virtually no instances of pogroms and murder and beating of Jews. But anti-Semitism, as it always is merely taking a time out. It's kind of like the Gentile idea of peace. It's the break you take between wars to rearm. So anti-Semitism in the 19th century is sort of like, you know, gathering its momentum to explode much more virulently in Western Europe than it will explode anywhere in human history. Obviously, I'm talking about the Holocaust. But just to show you that what is especially prominent is the gentleman's anti-Semitism, the intellectual anti-Semitism, the anti-Semitism which keeps people like Lionel Rothschild from being able to be a lord in England, even though I think he stood for the office 7 times or something because he couldn't take an oath on the Christian Bible, that kind of stuff. Okay, so it's sort of like, we'll try and we'll just, you know, not let you in. As you know, that great Groucho Marx line, I wouldn't want to be the member of anyone, of a country club that would have me as a member. It was that kind of things. You know, Jews can't get into this club and that university. But Jews do rise. But the anti-Semitism is there. And I want to read. Now, by the way, one of the great anti-Semitic thinkers of the Enlightenment. Anyone know? François-Marie Arnauld, who is better known to us as Arnauld. Something like that, like A-R-O-U-E-T. I don't know how to pronounce that in French. Arouet, something like that. Better known to us as Voltaire. Okay? One of the great, you know, the sacred, one of the great gods of the Enlightenment in terms of thinkers, was one of the most vicious anti-Semites in the modern world. I mean, unbelievable, the filth that spewed out of his mouth about the Jews. Just to read you a little bit of, it's incredible. This is for the Jews in the modern world. He says, in short, we find them only ignorant and barbarous people who have long united the most sordid avarice with the most detestable superstition and the most invincible hatred of every people by whom they are tolerated and enriched. Still, we ought not to burn them. I guess that's the Enlightenment influence, you know. They're disgusting subhuman slime who pollute the world, but we shouldn't kill them. It's not really in the spirit of the time. So, anyway. Shylock.
Merchant of Venice.
Well, Shylock is the character in The Merchant of Venice. Shakespeare's... Yeah, there was, but I think that's much later. I don't know, to be honest. But again, Jews are going to rise to tremendous positions of prominence. In the 19th century, there are going to be 36 Jewish cabinet ministers in Europe. But there weren't... I was trying to ride the Valkyries out the window there. No, okay. Getting wary to bring Wagner at the Kotel. It's actually Islam's greatest hits. Anyway, but you have 36 Jewish cabinet ministers, including one very important person who we have to mention now, Benjamin Disraeli, twice Prime Minister of England. Certainly, in terms of Queen Elizabeth, and this is the golden era of the English Empire, you know, and Victoria, the longest reigning monarch, I believe, in the history of England. I'm not sure. I'm not sure she is the longest, but one of the, probably could be the longest, but could be Henry III actually was reigned longer, but let's have to check that one out. Sorry? Not as long. Victoria was around for a long time. She used to call Disraeli Dizzy, you know, they went on a really cute first name basis there, you know, I guess he called her Vicky, you know, and I'm sure he didn't. No, he's called Dizzy. He's the twice prime minister, the great reforming, of course, being of Jewish descent, although albeit he, you know, his family converted to Church of England, so he could rise to that position. He can't get that Jewish soul out of you. You know, as Rabbi Berkowitz says, you can get baptized 100 times, you might get wet, but you'll always be Jewish. So he definitely, of course, being a Jew and being liberal, he's going to be a big reforming prime minister. But he's a classic example. You have tremendous amount of Jewish accomplishment at this time. You have in France especially, lots of Jewish politicians. Also Jewish prime minister. But it doesn't mean that the anti-Semitism is gone. Okay, so it's a double-edged sword here. The cloud has definitely, the nice cloud has definitely a dark lining to it. And if you read, this is during the time, especially in Germany, where a lot of anti-Semitic literature is going to come out about the Jews. Hitler, when he starts his anti-Semitic diatribes against the Jews, is merely copying what was said by some of the bigger German thinkers of the 19th century, one of whom is Wilhelm Marr, the man who coins the phrase anti-Semitism. The Germans, who, of course, in the late 19th century, evolution, Darwinian evolution, all that stuff was coming really big. Out of that comes racial theory, since in the natural kingdom we have survival of the fittest and superior evolved creatures outliving those who didn't evolve, etc. So the Germans are going to take Nietzsche and Darwin and come up with the pseudo-racial theory of inferior and superior and inferior races. And Marr, wanting to make hatred of Jews sound more racial and less religious, is going to coin the phrase anti-Semitism in 1879. In his book, he writes a book called The Victory of Judaism Over Germandom, which goes into 12 printings in 6 years. It's like a runaway bestseller. And by the way, if you read what these guys wrote, it is unbelievable. I don't know if I have all the quotes with me, but over Germandom. It has some really great, you know, Germany, every word is like, you know, instead of, you ever buy an appliance in America that has like a German, it's like electric, 5-speed electric blender with multiple adapters. In German, that's one word. That's like 27 letters long with like 65 vowels, those little umlauts in them. You know, so it's got some really interesting title that I can't pronounce. But Marr is one of the guys, you read what he says, it's unbelievable. His, by the way, he's not just ranting and raving. His understanding of what the Jew is incredibly profound and right on. Another guy is Karl Marie Düring, who wrote The Question of the Jew is a Question of Race. And I want to read you just one a little bit of this. This is 1881. He says, "The Jewish question would still exist, even if every Jew were to turn his back on his religion and join one of our major churches. Yes, I maintain that in that case, the struggle between us and the Jews would make itself felt even more urgent. It is precisely the baptized Jew who infiltrates furthest, unhindered, in all sectors of society and political life. I return, therefore, to the hypothesis that the Jews are not to be defined solely on the basis of race and not on the basis of religion. The Jews are to be defined solely on the basis of race and not on the basis of religion." Excuse me, that's very important, that not word there. I know, is word. He's saying it's not like a religious thing, and he's not, and by the way, he doesn't even mean this. He's meaning, Hitler's going to pick up on this definitely. He's going to say, and this is, by the way, checkmate for the Jews. It's very, look what happens to anti-Semitism. There's a very profound idea here. From the Jewish perspective, we talk about anti-Semitism as being a reminder to us, sometimes extremely harsh, to get our act together, and we can't escape our responsibility. Look what happens when the Jewish world is finally allowed to assimilate. Anti-Semitism is going to switch its attack. And, you know, the Christian world, if a Jew became Christian, he would be honored, you know. He'd get some big title and he'd go debate rabbis and get the Talmud burned or something like that. Now, Jews who want to convert, it is precisely the modern anti-Semitism saying, you know the most dangerous kind of Jew? The one who's not Jewish, who identifies as being a Christian or is assimilated. We've got to weed him out. This is very interesting that the Jew cannot escape by trying to assimilate. Okay, the anti-Semitism, God's not going to allow us to disappear. It's a very heavy idea. But this, if you look what he's saying now, you'll see where Hitler gets his ideas from. He doesn't care if you're a practicing Jew. If your great-grandmother's dog ate glatt kosher food, you're Jewish, he's going to kill you. Okay, and it comes from these ideas. It's not his original stuff. Okay, now, to put anti-Semitism on hold, because we're going to talk about, we're going to have a whole class just talking about World War II and the Holocaust, but the Jewish reaction to this new sort of Gentile attitude, forgetting the anti-Semitism, the nice attitude of the Gentile, is very, very interesting. It's very interesting. A large number of Jews are just going to assimilate or convert out, as we'll look at later. Okay, well, let's put that on topic on hold. But a major movement is going to come out of Judaism at this period of time, which is definitely a reaction to the challenges of modernity towards Judaism, which is the Reform movement. Now, after all, we have to see that Jews, until this period of time, they lived amongst Gentiles who were openly hostile and deliberately discriminated against Jews in all ways. Jews were forced to dress differently and act differently. And for the most part, Jews were happy to dress differently and act differently. When your neighbor was like some drunken, toothless, ignorant, wife-beating, anti-Semitic, you know, uneducated peasant, it wasn't a very attractive, you know, society to want to join. But now that we have educated Gentiles who walk around in nice suits and are nice to us and are allowing us into their universities and to have political office and be doctors and lawyers, maybe we should lower our guard a little here. Let's meet them halfway here. And the attitude was, in much of the Jewish community, especially in places like Germany, was, look, we shouldn't be so Jewish. Because they're telling us we don't have to be so Jewish anymore. They're telling us we can enter their society. So maybe if we meet them halfway, or even more than halfway, they'll be nicer to us. If we keep all these barriers up, we can't eat with them because we have kosher food and we wear these things on our heads and whatever, they're going to look at us as different. We won't be accepted. They're not going to give us the rights that we've wanted for so long. So there's going to be many different reactions that are going to come out of this. Conversion, assimilation, but the Reform movement is definitely a reaction to this specific challenge of the Jew in modernity. Okay, and it's very important. When I was growing up as a Reformed Jew, I was raised Reformed, but I didn't know anything about Judaism, nothing about Zionism. I always thought, by the way, that there was always Reformed Judaism, that Judaism always had these different groups in it. There was Reformed, Conservative, Orthodox. And it's true, there have been offshoot movements of Judaism, as you've seen before, Karaites and Sadducees. But those are offshoots. You have to always remember that the trunk of the tree throughout Jewish history, going back 3,300 years from Mount Sinai, is Torah observant Judaism. We call it orthodoxy. We shouldn't use that word because that's the word the Reform invented to describe religious Jews and make them seem backward, closed-minded, and ignorant of modernity. Okay, but it's a splinter movement. Now, this is very relevant today because in Israel, especially, one of the major things you always hear about in the news, and I'm sure it was used as a platform in probably 75% of Reform shuls on Yom Kippur, was attacking the Orthodox because of their monopoly on Judaism and their incredibly hostile attitude towards the Reform movement. They're not letting us breathe. Israel is a totalitarian Orthodox police state. You know, they're strangling us. If you understand the roots of the Reform Orthodox controversy in history, you'll get a much more profound understanding of how off that accusation is. We have to understand two basic things. Reform is an offshoot. They broke with the status quo. Fact. And number two, most important fact, Reform not only broke away, but went on the attack against Orthodox Judaism. Okay, we're talking about neo-Hellenists here in many respects, early Reform movement. I'm not talking about Reform today. We have to distinguish between what Reform movement says today and going back to the early 19th century. This is extremely important. And when I do this class, because we're dealing with a very large movement that encompasses a lot of Jews in the world, it's very important that you hear the voices of the founding fathers of Reform. Because what they say, as we say in yeshivish language, Hadas Baal Pi Kamo Me Edim Dami, the confession of the guy who's being accused is better than 100 guys testifying against him. You see very clearly what their agenda is. By the way, the founding father of the Reform movement, who's not Reform Jew, but is ideologically the person behind Reform Judaism, a man by the name of Moses Mendelssohn. And Moses Mendelssohn, who lived from 1724 to 1804, right in the middle of the Enlightenment, an ugly man, hunchback, genius, brilliant man, brilliant, very close personal friend of Immanuel Kant, one of the greatest philosophers of modern times, who, by the way, if you're interested in philosophy, from a Jewish perspective, Kant is amazing, incredible thinker, with a lot of ideas that are very Jewish. Immanuel Kant liked Moses Mendelssohn so much, he called him the Jewish Plato, little hunchback Mendelssohn. Now, Mendelssohn was an Orthodox Jew, but Mendelssohn had some ideas that were a little teeny bit off. Okay, a little teeny bit off, because they were affected by modern Enlightenment thinking. And one thing you see in Jewish history, and it's like the history of heresy in the Jewish world, or schism, is that a little idea, which is a little bit off at the time, is not such, may not do damage, but it's like making a small hole in a dam. A little water trickles through, but in a couple years, the Hoover Dam has no water left in it because the whole thing explodes open. And if you look at what Mendelssohn says, you can see that although he is a traditional Jew, he has an idea which is going to spiral out of control. Not because he wanted it to. I'm sure Mendelssohn would not be happy with the Reform movement, not at all. But his ideas were taken by them. This is Moses Mendelssohn, Judaism as Revealed Legislation, 1783. Religious doctrines and propositions are eternal truths about God and his government and providence, without which man cannot be enlightened and happy. These are not forced upon the faith of a nation under the threat of eternal or temporal punishment, but in accordance with the nature and evidence of eternal truths recommended to rational acknowledgement. The Supreme Being has revealed them to all rational creatures. He's obsessed with the word rational, by the way. He's sort of saying, yeah, Jewish lifestyle, you know, commandments, that's cool. But, you know, it should make sense. It's rational that we do it. Meaning, if we get into a conflict between what makes sense to me and what God tells me to do, where am I going to go? I'm going to follow. What's the Enlightenment perspective on this? I'm going to follow what makes sense to me. It's a very dangerous attitude. That is not the Jewish attitude. Yeah, which, by the way, Jews are not irrational. Jews are the great rationalists of human history. The people who taught the world, the ultimate believers in cause and effect and process are the Jewish people, whether it's in science or in history or in thought, are the Jews. So we're not talking about copping out here. But when we get to looking at what Simpson or Fallon Hirsch says, we'll see the difference between the kosher way of looking at this ideology and Mendelssohn's, which is slightly off. Yeah.
But I mean, another part of the puzzle could be that, you know, people like, even going back to Ezra and then Baruch Spinoza and then John Strzok, all those people, you know, building on one upon the other with looking at the Torah in with higher biblical criticism and lower biblical criticism, which eventually got to Wellhausen, which is a different ballgame altogether, I agree, but at least with Ibn Ezra and even with Baruch Spinoza, you had serious doubts as to the authorship.
No, not Ibn Ezra. That is a misreading by modern Bible critics. Ibn Ezra has no doubts about the Bible. I'm sorry. That's a classic. Spinoza, to put Spinoza in the same sentence with Ibn Ezra is not fair to the Ibn Ezra. Spinoza is the founding father of Bible criticism, for sure. I would agree with that. And I really don't want to get into this now because but Bible criticism is not an objective a study of the text. All Jewish scholars throughout Jewish history are Bible critics. Meaning every work of literature could be analyzed to draw out comparisons, text, how things are used, get deeper meanings. That's a Jewish thing. The notion of Bible criticism, of authorship of the text of the Bible, which comes out of the Enlightenment, begins with the agenda that God doesn't write the Bible. and therefore is going to follow logically along to justify that position. It's not an objective appreciation of the text. A guy like a Spinoza, who's one of the great sacred secular, you know, one of the great people venerated by secular philosophers of the modern world, is someone who was, you know, thrown out of his synagogue in Amsterdam and excommunicated because his ideas were completely antithetical to Judaism, but not Ibn Ezra. If you want afterwards, I could talk a little more about it, but that's a misreading of Ibn Ezra. But I don't want to get into it now because I want to get to the reform while we're on the momentum here. Out of this, by opening up Judaism to rational skepticism. Now, being skeptical is a very Jewish thing. You can question whatever you want, but you have to come from a certain belief. Once you move out of that belief system, you know, God-given Torah, or whatever, you're opening up the gates, and all the animals are going to run loose in the fields there. The floodgates spill, the dam breaks, everything spills out. The Reform movement came out of an ideology of let us remove those barriers which are keeping us from entering Western civilization. The Gentiles are now nice people. We don't need to have to live in our ghettoized environment. We need a new form of Judaism. They weren't calling for conversion. They say we need a new form of Judaism, nominally Jewish, but enabling us to enter Western civilization. The Reform movement is going to begin. The first Reform temple is in Hamburg, Germany. It's October 18th, 1818. Easy to remember, right? October 18th, 1818. And I want to read you what these people say because, again, their own accounts of how they look at their religion say oceans about the early Reform movement and its ideology. This is the New Israelite Temple Association Constitution of Hamburg Temple, December 11, 1817, from the Jews in the Modern World. The worship service shall be conducted on Sabbath and holidays. Specifically, there should be introduced at such services a German sermon and choral singing to the accompaniment of an organ. Let's be like the Lutheran ministers. Take the kippah off. Okay, we're going to do it in German with a sermon with an organ. By the way, Temple Emmanuel in New York, the extreme reform in America, are going to move the Sabbath till Sunday. We got to be like the Christians because we got to be the same. And not only that, but more importantly, there's a huge shift in how Jews perceive themselves. Forgetting the trappings of Jewish observance, more basic than that, Jews always viewed themselves as strangers in a strange land. We are in diaspora. It is a punishment. We are meant to go back to the land of Israel. We are people who are a nation, albeit a nation in exile. We're supposed to be back in the land of Israel with a temple. Therefore, when we pray in Judaism, we mention building the temple, returning the Sanhedrin, returning the kingship, the messianic redemption. All of these are statements of a separate Jewish national identity in the land of Israel and a separate Jewish destiny in history. Those two ideas are completely antithetical to the early Reform movement because we are saying, by us saying this when we pray, the Reform movement said, is we're saying we're not like you. We're just here temporarily. Don't treat us the same as you because we're not. We're supposed to be back in Israel. This is a very important point, to the point where the early Reform movement, besides switching to German, dropped any references to rebuilding the temple, messianic redemption. Let's not use Hebrew because a national language means we're a nation. We don't want that. Okay, forget all that stuff. And forget thinking we're not Jews as a nation. We are Germans of the Mosaic persuasion. That's what they call themselves. We're Germans first. We happen to have this religious identity on the side called Jews. And forget going back to Israel. We're here to stay. And what do they say? Hamburg or Frankfurt is our Jerusalem or Berlin is our Jerusalem. Germany is our Israel. This is what they're saying 100 years before the Holocaust. No one became more German than German Jews. They were going to go out of their way to show how loyal they were. Germans of the Mosaic persuasion. We drop all of that national association. Judaism is a side religious thing. We are members of Western society, specifically we're members of Germany. And I want to read. And by the way, the big founding intellectual to the Reform movement are two guys, Abraham Geiger, 1810 to 1874, who's an extreme reformist, and Samuel Holdheim. So remember those guys? Holdheim, Geiger. Holdheim is 1806 to 1860. Geiger is really the spiritual father of the Reform movement. And he wrote a book called Anatomy of the Rabbis. He just rips traditional Judaism to shreds in the book. And I want to read you a couple more things from, because there's a big debate in the Reform movement, like what's Reform Judaism going to have, what isn't it going to have? So they had this number of conferences. One of them is the Brunswick Conference in 1844. And I want to read you a couple of minutes from these conferences to show you how different is the attitude. This is the Reform Rabbinic Conference, Brunswick, the Question of Patriotism, June 1844. Naftali Frankfurter, preacher of the Reformed Temple, Frankfurt. For Judaism, the principle of human dignity is cosmopolitan, but I would like to put proper emphasis on the love for a particular people among whom we live and its individual members. As men, we love all mankind, but as Germans, we love the Germans as children of the fatherland. We are and ought to be patriots, not merely cosmopolitan. I mean, you read this now and you kind of feel sick. This is 100 years before the Holocaust, and they're talking about how German we are and we're citizens of the fatherland. Here's the Reform Rabbinical Conference at Frankfurt. Hebrew is a language of Jewish prayer. Listen to this. 1845. By considering Hebrew as being of central importance to Judaism, moreover, one would define it as a national religion, because a separate language is a characteristic element of a separate nation. But no member of this conference, the speaker concluded, would wish to link Judaism to a particular nation. Dump Hebrew. By the way, the Reform movement was virulently anti-Zionist in its inception. Zionism comes early 19th, late 19th century. That's the ultimate expression of everything they went against, a national fulfillment of a Jew as a Hebrew, a modern Jew living in his own land. Here's the Frankfurt Conference, the question of Messianism, 1845. This is whole time. One, again, leading intellectuals of the Reform movement. The hope for national restoration contradicts our feelings for the fatherland. The wish to return to Palestine in order to create their political empire is superfluous. But messianic hope truly understood is religious. This latter religious hope can be renounced only by those who have a more sublime conception of Judaism and who believe that the fulfillment of Judaism's mission is not dependent on the establishment of a Jewish state, but rather by a merging of Jewry into the political constellation of the fatherland. Only an enlightened conception of religion can replace a dull one. This is the difference between strict orthodoxy and reform. Both approach Judaism from a religious standpoint, but while the former aims at restoration of an old political order, the latter aims at the closest possible union with the political and national union of our times. Okay, very interesting. They're saying that orthodoxy, by the way, closed-minded, backward, ghettoized, versus reform, open, modern. Dump all of that national stuff. Real Jewish identity is only made by merging Jewish identity with German identity.
Well, were they saying lies about what was going on then with Orthodoxy?
Tremendous lies. No, their attack against Orthodoxy was totally vicious, as we'll see. But we have to appreciate that it's a complete about face of everything that is basically Judaism. In terms of national identity, historical mission, everything is different. Now, the most important thing to focus on, as it wasn't enough for the Reform movement to split away and say, Orthodox, you do your thing, we'll do ours. This is the classic pattern of Jewish self-hate. I'm going to change, and if I'm going to change, I'm going to take the rest of the Jewish people with me. Because as long as there's an Orthodox community that is saying, yes, we are strangers in a strange land with a different identity and a different national awareness and language, the Gentiles are going to say, Reform guys, you're playing games. This is the real what real Judaism believes. The Reform movement went nuts on the Orthodox, attacking, especially in places like in Frankfurt on Main. They banned kosher slaughter, closed down the mikvahs, banned the teaching of Torah. They got the German authorities, these local councils, Jewish councils. They seized control of the councils and basically embarked on a holy war against Judaism, very similar to what goes on in Greece during the time of the Maccabees. We will sick the Germans on you. You Jews, you can't learn Talmud anymore. You can't preach anymore. No more kosher food. No more teaching Hebrew. They even hounded, they put people out of business. They literally physically hounded people out of the community, not in front of beating people up in the streets, but just short of that. We're talking about a war here, okay? Because we cannot allow you Orthodox people to be around. Because until you get with the program, become modern, okay, we will not be accepted. There is nothing worse than a Jew who tries to out-Gentile the Gentiles. And we have to appreciate, if you want to see why the Orthodox reaction is going to be so strong against Reform, not only is it going to be ideologically and philosophically totally against what Reform tries to do to Judaism, but on a more basic level, you guys coming after me. If you're going to start punching me, I'm going to defend myself and punch you back. We have to understand who fired the first shots in this conflict. Very important. Very, very important. Okay, I think I'm going to stop now because I want to tomorrow pick up with, again, very important, the whole issue of the reaction of the Orthodox world to Reform. Okay, because the reaction is very interesting. And it also says a lot about the modern reaction of the Orthodox world towards modernity and to the Reform movement. You'll see where it comes from when we look. We have to appreciate that the battle lines are drawn here and who's firing the first shots. Okay, and again, it's very important when looking at this material just to see what the people who are involved in the movement say. It's very clear from the mouths of the founding fathers of the Reform movement in Germany, their attitude. They say it all. I don't have to add additional commentary. Okay, so guys, we'll pick it up tomorrow with Jewish reaction to Reform and lots of other interesting things going on in Europe.
This program is part of a series. For the continuation, please insert the next disc.